and welcome to a special edition of the ISACA podcast. I'm Megan Moritz, ISACA's Director of Global Volunteer Engagement, and will be serving as the host for this podcast. We have an exciting episode today with a very special guest who will be sharing inspired stories, insightful discussion, some fun and games, and more. But first, I have an announcement exclusively for ISACA members. On November 30th, ISACA's membership experience team will be hosting a special event, ISACA's first ever ISACA speaker series, a complimentary member-exclusive CPE-eligible event. This is the premier event in a series of experiences centered around ideas on leadership, including leading an organization, others, and yourself. The series will feature global voices and leading figures across digital trust domains, businesses, and cultures. Members can register for the complimentary event by going to isaca.org. Okay, so today's guest for our podcast is Erica Dewan. Erica is going to be the inaugural presenter at the ISACA Speaker Series on November 30th. She is an award-winning speaker and best-selling author on topics such as connectional intelligence and digital body language, the latter of which she'll be presenting about during the Speaker Series. It is a privilege to have her with me today. Welcome to the podcast, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me here.
It is such a pleasure to be speaking with you. Before we jump into what digital body language is, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, something fun or fascinating on a little more of a personal level?
Yeah, well, Megan, I grew up as a shy, introverted girl. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My parents were Indian immigrants, so at home, we spoke Hindi, which meant when I got to school, I really struggled to find my voice. I had accented English. And in every report card from kindergarten through 12th grade, I often got good grades, but every teacher said, I wish Erica spoke up more in class. And, you know, for me, just personally, one of the ways I was really able to find my voice was understanding the true value of body language. At school, I would watch the popular girls with their heads high, the cool kids slouching during school assemblies. At home, I would watch Bollywood movies that were in different languages from different parts of India, and I couldn't understand anything they were saying, but I could read an entire storyline through their facial expressions. And in many ways, I think because I was an immigrant to traditional body language as a kid, and in many ways it became my superpower, today I'm so passionate at helping us all navigate the world of being immigrants at digital body language. So that's a little bit about me.
Awesome. Awesome. That's such a cool story. And it's so difficult to imagine that you were a shy, introverted girl. Okay. So the reason we're here today is to discuss your best-selling book, Digital Body Language, How to Build Trust and Connection No Matter the Distance. For those who are listening and may be interested in purchasing a copy, you can find a link on the podcast summary page. So the first question that comes to mind is, of course, what inspired you to write this book?
Over the last 10 years, I've been an expert helping leaders and teams build 21st century collaboration skills and behaviors. How do we lead in global, virtual, multi-generational, matrixed environments? But about 4 or 5 years ago, I kept hearing teams asking the same questions. Questions like, why is there so much misunderstanding at work? Questions like, how do we better connect with different ages and working styles? And in many ways, what I realized underneath those questions is just like we had a rule book for traditional body language for how we best communicate in the office, the head nod, the handshake, the lean in a sales conversation, there was no rule book for the body of our language in a digital world. I'll never forget sending a message to a client saying, do you want to speak Wednesday or Thursday? The response was yes. And then I had no idea what to do, or getting one of those no subject, no agenda calendar invitations and being anxious about a meeting the next day. This is what inspired me to write the book. I realized that not only I was dealing with the misunderstanding and anxiety and confusion that often comes with the lack of tone and body of our language and digital communications, but that I realized every single person, whether you're working in a large organization or small, needs these skills to thrive in our modern era.
Well, clearly audiences have responded. What have they been saying to you or asking you about the book?
You know, it's so funny. I think the key thing I often hear when individuals have read the book or heard me present about the book is, I feel validated. I feel heard. We never talked about this. I'll give you an example. I know a leader who was reviewing some slides with her team on a video call. She said something of the likes of, let's iterate on this a bit more. What she really meant was, let's add two more bullet points. But her team took it as a big work directive because she was really brief and ambiguous. She wasn't clear. They spent about 10 hours on 5 new slides. Imagine how demotivated they felt when it turned into 2 bullet points. And I think the real lesson of this, of that story, and for many of us, is this is a whole new skill set that really matters. Skills like valuing others visibly is not just a handshake or a head nod, but it's valuing others' time, inboxes, and schedules. And communicating carefully is not having good executive presence just in front of someone face to face. It's knowing that reading messages carefully is the new listening and writing clearly is the new empathy. And so if I were to really sum up what, what's been exciting and what people have resonated with, I think it's giving us a language so that we can better define norms to create more understanding, connection, and collaboration, regardless of where we're sitting, where what level we're in, and where we are around the world.
I'm sitting here shaking my head and smiling so big because I know exactly that, like, 10 hours worth of work for 2 bullet points would be like, oh my God, are you kidding me right now? Yeah, that'd be really, really hard. So at the event on November 30th, you'll be talking to ISACA members about digital body language. So ISACA is a growing global community of more than 150,000 members from more than 180 countries. ISACA is advancing the best talent, expertise, and learning in technology. Can you give us a taste of what ISACA members might expect to hear during the speaker series on November 30th?
Yeah. Well, ISACA members will not only learn what digital body language is, why it matters to them, but they'll also learn practical actions that they can take as an individual to thrive in our new modern digital environment, and also to implement a set of rituals or norms on their teams to create that sense of clarity, regardless of the person in the distance. Some of the individual skills that ISACA members will learn are things like hold your horses, which means in a world of digital communication, less haste equals more speed. You don't want to reward always the fastest person who responds to your email or the quickest person who jumps in on a video call. Remember when it was okay to just stroke your chin or furrow your eyebrows in a live meeting and people gave you time to think? Now, if you're not speaking, they'll ask if you're on mute. And so, again, I'll talk a little bit about how do you prioritize thoughtfulness over hastiness? How do you create cultures of inclusion and never confuse a brief message with a clear message? Then I'll go into team norms and I'll introduce what I call 4 laws of digital body language that will allow anyone to make sure they can bridge and build that connection and trust, whether it's someone on their team they've worked with for years or someone they've never met before. And I'll also share best practices by digital channel, because not all channels are equal. And there are certain factors ranging from complexity, urgency, and priority. The last thing that I think many people will be excited to learn is what their digital body language style is. Just like traditional leadership assessments, we all have to understand that there are different communication styles, and not only knowing our own, but how to best connect with those that are different will allow us to truly thrive moving forward.
So it's interesting, as you've been talking about this and as I was preparing for this podcast, when I thought digital body language in my head, I thought, okay, it's the way that I sit on camera. It's whether or not, you know, I have my hair done or whatever. But this is the way you're explaining it is much more the tone of the way you're communicating, and that, you know, we're having meetings via Zoom and Teams and all these other platforms, and making sure that you're being aware of that presence, not just exactly how you're sitting in a digital space. So I thought that was a...
That's right.
Yeah. Very, very interesting.
Just like traditional body language makes up all of the signals and cues that make up roughly 70% of face-to-face communication, digital body language are all the cues we send in our digital communication, email, video call, hybrid meeting, even when we're in a face-to-face meeting and looking down at our phones, that make up how others feel about us in a modern marketplace. So everything from the punctuation we use in an email to how quickly we respond to whether we choose to email, call, video call, these are not trivial decisions. They are cues of complexity, urgency, priority. They give others a sense of how they should engage back. And I'd argue that video presence does matter. I'll talk a little bit about that. But you can have a terrible meeting where people feel disengaged and have a nice background and look good on camera. It's not just about that. Digital body language is about showing that you care, that you hear them, you understand them, and you are engaging them in a way that they feel respected, valued, and included.
So this is a very selfish comment. This has absolutely nothing to do with Erica or Isaka. But to all the young people out there, please use punctuation in your text messages. It makes it so much easier to read. It's so hard reading a message from a 19-year-old and you're like, where is this going? I don't understand where I'm supposed to pause. So anyway, that's my plea to the youth of
the world. I'll just add to that, Megan, I share a study in my book, Digital Body Language, that digital natives who tend to skew younger think a period at the end of a text means passive aggressiveness. So what may work for one group may not work for others. And that's what you'll learn a little bit about in the session.
All right. Well, maybe I'll be attending that session. All right. So let's rewind the clock a little bit and get your perspective on something. So I have worked with our nearly 3,000 volunteer chapter leaders for more than 18 years at Isaka. And I know I've spent a lot of time creating meaningful connections, both personally and professionally, across different cultures, ages, and working styles. How did creating meaningful connections come into your life? I know you talked a little bit about that when you were really young, but can you explain to our listeners why creating those types of connections is so important?
You know, I think a lot of the ways that we measure relationships, especially in the digital world, is quantity of connections, how many Facebook likes we have, how many LinkedIn followers we have. And I think in many ways, based on my background, where I always had to translate or bridge different cultures, different complexities, I learned that in many ways, there are always places and spaces where people can meaningfully connect together. And it's not about having a lot of networks. It's about how you use, how you intelligently engage your networks and relationships. And about 10 years ago, that's what really spawned my journey in leadership development. Previous to that, I was a financial services professional. I worked at Lehman Brothers, and I worked through the financial collapse at Lehman Brothers. And it was that moment, working through the world's largest bankruptcy and collapse that rippled the world. It taught me it's not what teams do, it's how teams work. And there were a lot of connections happening, but they lacked true understanding, true care, true value. And we all know what the business impacts of that were. And that's what led me to write my first book, which is called Get Big Things Done, The Power of Connectional Intelligence, which I would argue rewrites the rules that collaboration is not about more meetings and more emails. It's about asking ourselves, what can we each bring to serve a shared purpose together? How can we unlock our individual expertise in a way that will allow us to exponentially learn and grow together? And how do we sustain this collaboration over time? And I'll sum this up with one story that I think will remind us all the importance of the fact that meaningful connections require us to open our eyes to different people, ideas, and mindsets. This is a story about a toothpaste company, Colgate-Palmolive. And at this company, a team of chemists had developed a new fluoride they were mixing in their toothpaste, but there was a mechanical flow problem. The fluoride was getting stuck in the equipment and no one could figure out why. After months and months, finally one team member said, "Why don't we ask a different network? We haven't solved this." And they posted the question on an online website of scientists. Within 2 days, a physicist on the site solved the problem. He helped them realize it was a physics problem, not a chemistry problem. Now the Colgate team learned that they hadn't even asked the physicists at their own company because they had labeled it as a chemistry problem. And that physicist that solved the problem would have never been hired by Colgate. So when it comes to meaningful connections today, I think it really starts by asking ourselves, not how do we connect more, but how do we connect intelligently? It's about asking ourselves, how do we not only connect with who we know, but who we don't know yet? And last but not least, how do we ensure we don't just create moments where we connect one time, but we reimagine ways to continually engage over years? And I think that's what communities like Isaka are really all about.
Yeah, I love when you say it's less about what you do and how you do it and how you work together. And it's just so important. If my God, so important. So before you authored two books and earned degrees from Harvard and MIT Sloan and the Wharton School, which makes me feel like an incredible underachiever, by the way, you were a young person, as you mentioned, growing up in Pittsburgh in an Indian American family. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it helped shape the ideas you came to write about?
Yeah. You know, growing up in a suburban conservative neighborhood outside of Pittsburgh, I always felt like an outsider. I didn't feel like I fit in. And then, you know, when I went to India, my Indian cousins would call me the American-born cousin. I mean, who in India is named Erica? So I really struggled. And in many ways, that became a guiding thread for me, that there's always a space in the middle where we can navigate difference and distances. And I think that one moment that really changed how I think was right after 9/11, September 11th in the United States, where there was a lot of, you know, sentiment or anti-Asian sentiment. And my father, who is a cardiologist and, you know, a tall Indian man, was waiting for me after a soccer practice. And I was in high school at that time. And while he was waiting for me outside of a local YMCA, this was just about a month after September 11th, one man saw him just waiting outside and deemed him suspicious and called the cops on him. And I remember coming out of the soccer practice and watching him being frisked by police and, you know, letting the police know that he was just a local cardiologist. He worked at a nearby hospital. We lived 10 minutes away. And, you know, I remember him being so different, you know, his palms open, his eye contact direct, his voice assertive, but also different. And I remember being, you know, driving home with him that day and being so angry, angry at the police, angry at what had happened. But he said something to me that day. He said, you know, wouldn't it be helpful to step into the shoes of how others are feeling right now? And in many ways, I think his reminder of the importance of empathy and how empathy can be built through body language really reminded me that in any type of challenging situation, we can connect, we can break boundaries, but it does involve showcasing empathy and looking at it differently. And in many ways, I think that guiding thread of empathy and the ways that we bridge connection, even when it's difficult or it's different, and cascading that into our new modern global digital marketplace is what I believe so much about and what I hope that many people will learn from the skills of digital body language.
I loved hearing that story. And I challenge everybody who's listening to just take that moment to think back to something that may have shaped a decision you made in your life that you never really have given much thought to. But when you do, you're like, wow, that really made an impact and really drove kind of who I am today. That's a big, important thing to realize. So you mentioned earlier on that you actually were a shy, timid child, which again is very hard to imagine seeing you here and talking to you. At what point did you know you wanted to do public speaking, right? You were the author, but when was it like, I want to be on a stage?
You know, I never had a plan to do public speaking. I wanted to make a difference. And I think in many ways, what I learned as I was working on my thought leadership, writing my books, was that it's not what we say, it's not just what we put out in the world, it's how we say it. And I think so much of that is driven by learning about the importance of communication. And I would be honest, I'll say that learning how to speak and becoming a keynote speaker was a thread more than a plan. I started sharing the ideas to different groups, and then other groups called me and they called me back. And then I realized that speaking is a powerful tool to bring new ideas to the table. But it's not just about me sharing ideas. It's about creating a community conversation that allows us all to share opinions, share our mindsets and skills. And I'll be honest, as a result of the digital shift, with so much of virtual speaking happening more than ever, the power of engaging hundreds or thousands of people in a chat tool, I think has transformed how I feel about speaking, where I'm getting real-time feedback or moving into a quick breakout room where everyone can have a deep dive lesson or conversation about a topic and then coming back together, I think is transforming meetings. And last but not least, even just the power of virtual whiteboards and other tools so that we can have collective conversations is what I love so much about speaking in our modern world. And I think what I hope to continue to do, especially around the skills of digital body language.
Awesome. Yeah, I could not agree more. And it's so cool, though, that you found that thread and that it's worked well for you and that you've been successful at it. So congratulations.
I thought maybe I'll be a Bollywood dancer, but I failed at that. So.
Okay, well, speaking of that, you mentioned you did soccer, you mentioned the Bollywood thing. So is there anything else that you did for fun when you were younger? And also, what do you do for fun now? Like, are you still doing the Bollywood dancing thing?
You know, I'll be honest, I dance a lot. In some ways, I think movement in our body activates our mind. And we all know that, especially as we've been sitting in our chairs often for the last 18 months with very little movement for many of us. I think that there are a couple things I love. I love experiences that help me to be in a different place and see with new eyes. So sometimes that's reading an amazing leadership book. I'm a total leadership book junkie. Sometimes that is dancing to a song. I love Bollywood and I also love African dance. And these days it's dancing to Disney songs with my two small kids. And last but not least, I'm a huge fan of the power of meditation and just taking that time to really center ourselves versus when we connect with others. So those are some of the things I love to do now. And I think when I was small, I think because I was in a very traditional family, I think a lot of the emphasis was schoolwork and studying. And I do go back to Bollywood dance, actually, because I think it was one of those formats of expression when a lot of the other ways of being as a kid were about being studious. Maybe that's why I have so many degrees, not because I necessarily needed them all.
You know, it's when you're doing a podcast, obviously you want to focus on the other person, but I could sit here and like, we could just go back and forth. Like, oh my God, I love, right? Like I dance in my living room all the time. Yes. No one's there. Yeah, it's amazing. It is such a release. And when people are like, oh, I don't want to dance, I'm not good at it, I'm like, there is no, just move. Like,
just
it's okay.
Move. And just go move. For a walk, whatever it is, listening to a song on your AirPods. I think the more we can get away from our screens, the more we'll be better when we're on them.
Yeah, I love that. I'm going to get that on a t-shirt. Okay, so you're now this award-winning speaker. You've been on stages worldwide with impressive audiences. What's the main message that global audiences seem to be seeking at this point in time?
You know, I think the main message that many audiences are seeking is how do we innovate faster and further together? We have been given all these tools and technology to be able to collaborate effectively. But in many ways, some of the tools that have been meant to enable us to collaborate better are eroding human collaboration. We're on terrible video call meetings. We're dealing with a reply all epidemic. We have meetings that should be emails and vice versa. We're adding collaboration platforms that aren't properly replacing an existing platform. So they're just wasting time and over communication. And I think that the message we all have to ask ourselves is how will we innovate faster and further? And that doesn't involve one more meeting. It involves really taking this moment not to connect more, but to connect intelligently. So that's a message that I really hope to bring to the Asaka session that we'll be doing together. And also, I think to anyone just feeling a need for not more connection, but more meaningful connection.
Yeah. More meetings is not great if it's just more meetings, right? It needs to be meaningful.
Let's bring back the 10-minute meeting. No more 30 and 60-minute.
Yeah, I love when it's like, I'm scheduling it for 30. It'll probably only take 15. I'm like, well, then schedule it for 15. Yes. It'll be taking 15 extra minutes of my time.
Even simple things. Have a good subject title. Clarify what's the agenda. What's the outcome? These are signals of good empathy and respect now.
Agreed. Okay. So before we jump to the crazy part of this podcast, there is a crazy part. I did want to make an exciting announcement. So One in Tech and Isaka Foundation seeks to create a healthy digital world that is safe, secure, and accessible for all. The foundation focuses on building equity and diversity in the digital world. Erica graciously partnered with One in Tech to provide 5 scholarships to her online course, Digital Body Language. Erica, can you tell us a little bit about this online course?
Yeah. Digital Body Language, the Expert Course, is a series of 8 modules that will give you not only skills that you'll learn in this session, but actually a playbook with homework and exercises for you not only to continue to build your digital body language skills, but also to get feedback from others. So it includes a digital body language assessment checklist so you can continue to improve, whether on video camera or in your regular emails. And last but not least, it allows you to get a set of tools that will ensure that you continue to build these skills over time. So I'm really excited to share them with the foundation and excited to see who joins the community.
Indeed. So these scholarships will support the leadership development of underrepresented cybersecurity professionals who are students, recent graduates, or are within their first 2 years of a cyber-related professional role. So if you out there or someone you know is interested, visit oneintech.org to apply. And thank you so much for your generosity, Erica. All right, we're going to take this podcast to a whole other level. We're going to play a little game. Erica, you're going to be the contestant. We haven't really talked about this, but since it's just you and me, I'm going to put you in the hot seat. All right, here we go. So remember, everybody, earlier in the podcast, I mentioned that Erica's presenting at that first ever member-only speaker series on November 30th. You do need to be an ISACA member. So even if you're listening to this podcast and you're not an ISACA member and you want to attend that event, you do need to join. Even if you hold one of ISACA's prestigious certifications but are not yet a member, you still have time to join before the event. Simply go to isaka.org/join. All right, with that little sales pitch out of the way, are you ready to play the game, Erica?
I'm ready.
All right, we're going to call this game the Do's and Don'ts of Digital Body Language. I'm sure there are things all of us do that we don't even notice. For this game, I'm going to provide you with 3 scenarios, and then you will give us the do or the don't and the why. For those listening in, you can play along by yourself, which isn't as much fun, of course, but we don't want you to feel totally left out. So, all right, Erica, here we go. Scenario number 1, I'm a manager. I work quickly. Sometimes a phone call is quicker than an email. Today, I need a quick answer for a project update. So I email my employee. In the subject line, I write, please call me and hit send. Is this a do or a don't and why?
This is a don't. In our messages, there are 2 other factors that impact how others read them, trust and power. Now, because there is a power dynamic in that situation, I would encourage you, instead of saying, please call me, to take a moment to just clarify the importance and the subject of the actual call. This will avoid a situation when there's a power dynamic for a more junior colleague to feel anxious or concerned or to think they're about to get fired. And the other factor is trust. And when there is high trust, if they know your style, it may be a little more okay, but I would still err on the side of being a bit more clear about what the call is about before you ask them to call you.
Makes sense. All right. Scenario number 2. I'm an employee. It's Monday. I'm working on a project for a client and I'm on a roll. Before I know it, it's late in the day, like after dinner, but I know I can finish the project if I have just one more piece of information, so I decide to text my manager. Do you have a minute to talk? She replies a moment later with, depends. I try to quickly summarize my question and realize I've typed a short paragraph with punctuation. Ultimately, there are 2 options, each with pros and cons. I need an answer by noon tomorrow. I send the lengthy text and I await a reply. Do, don't, why?
I would say here, can I have a middle one, which is it depends, but I'll lead with a don't. I'll lead with a don't. Now, you know, more than ever with the constant 24-hour craze of how we work, it can feel comfortable to creep into people's text messages late at night. But I would argue that the rule for sending messages late at night, the only rule where I think it's appropriate is if it's truly urgent to be responded to that night. If not, I would encourage you to switch the channel to send an email and say, you know, need this by noon tomorrow, need this by 11 a.m. knowing that there's a clear norm that your manager checks their email in the morning. In many ways, that long, lengthy text could come at an inopportune time when your manager is dealing with their small kids or in, at a dinner outside. And I'd argue you only truly have the right to text them late at night if something is truly that urgent. So not everyone's schedules are the same. And I think one of the lessons out of this one is make sure you set some clear collaboration norms where it's okay to text, but in these certain situations, and when it's better to just email or wait for that group phone call the next day to ask.
Okay, so now I feel like I should apologize to my boss. If you're listening, I'm sorry. Okay, scenario number three. I'm the owner of a small consulting firm, yay me. After a painstaking bidding process, we win the contract. Woohoo! This project could be a game changer for our business. The CEO of the company emails me to congratulate me and my team. She refers to me as Miss Moritz. No one ever refers to me as Miss Moritz. But I also get a text from the vice president of marketing that says, congratulations, Megan. Thumbs up emoji. I was rooting for you. TTYL. High five emoji. I want to get started on the right foot. I'm nervous. I'm excited. So I respond separately to each of them. I email the CEO using her title, doctor, and I text the VP of marketing, including emojis, trying my best to match each of their tones. Do, don't, why?
I would say in this situation, do. And the reason why is when it comes to building new relationships where we don't have existing trust, just like in a traditional body language setting, when I smile, you may tend to smile back and we tend to mirror body language. When we're trying to build trust with others, it can actually be helpful to mirror their digital body language. So if you already get the cues that one person is a bit more formal and another person is a bit more informal, it can be helpful to match those cues. At the end of the day, though, I'm a big fan of also being authentic. So as you get to build trust with those individuals, begin to use more of your natural, authentic style. But it doesn't hurt to perhaps in a new relationship, especially when it's virtual first, don't shy away from mirroring their digital body language.
With proper punctuation.
Yeah, if they use it. But if they don't, maybe you don't need it.
Oh, man.
That will really upset Megan, so I know not to do that with you.
That would be so stressful. If somebody sent me a text with no punctuation, you can tell I have a problem with this. All right, anyway, bonus scenario for you. I'm a guest on a podcast. The host plays a Bollywood song. The host encourages the listeners to dance. For those who know me, I have no problem dancing along. Do, don't, or why?
Do, absolutely. If you've heard anything from this podcast, you know that I'm in.
All right, listeners, if you haven't tried Bollywood dancing yet, I've been told it's easy and fun. So, Erica, I know a little bit about the twisting a light bulb with one hand and petting a dog with the other. What are some of the other dance moves that we need to know here?
The wave up and down. Up and down. And then to the side. One side to the other side.
A little bit like a hula.
I'm just imagining a global Osaka dance party that's happening right now with these moves.
I wonder if anybody's in their car trying this. Please be careful if you're driving. So all the moves. We got it. Anything with your lower body? What if you're standing? Do you want to like move your hips or anything?
Hips. You can't see my hips, but it's up and down with the hips.
Got it. All right. And I'm assuming you've got to have attitude, right? Anytime you dance, you have to have attitude.
Attitude. Use your facial expressions. Emote. It's fun. It's joyful. And let's bring the power of fun and inspiration and even dance back to the virtual room.
Excellent. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this Isaka podcast. Isaka members, registration is open for the complimentary members only speaker series on November 30th. If you are not an Isaka member, we invite you to join our growing global community at isaka.org/join. Erica, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure speaking with you. Listeners, visit the link on the podcast summary page to purchase Erica's book. Erica, we'll see you again at the Isaka member event on November 30th. I'm Megan Moritz. Let's dance!